Welcome to Consilience, an African science podcast, brought to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Consilience is a weekly podcast dedicated to promoting reason, skepticism, and a scientific worldview in Africa and beyond.
Welcome to Consilience. Today is July 17th, 2011, and I'm Owen Swart. Joining me today are Michael Meaden.
Good evening.
And Angela Meaden.
Bonjour. Well, I don't want to be accused of greeting people the same way every single episode, so I'm doing an even on you and pulling out some random foreign bonsoir.
All right, then.
Okay. Whatever, I don't know.
All right, let's teach Angela to appreciate history.
Yeah, and she's teaching herself.
Oh, that's good.
Yay! I actually got to choose my own topic this week, which is nice. So in teaching Angela to appreciate history, we basically tell me something interesting about history because I'm a Philistine and don't find history very interesting. So my husband has taken it upon myself to teach me history.
Just the way I like it. Taking it upon yourself.
Nice.
Okay, so July 20th, 1822 was the birthday, the original first birthday of Gregor Mendel, dubbed the father of modern genetics. He was an Augustinian friar who experimented with inheritable traits in pea plants, which he demonstrated to follow the two laws, which were later called the laws of Mendelian inheritance. Those two laws are the law of segregation, which is when an individual produces gametes, the copies of a gene separate so that each gamete receives only one copy, and the law of independent assortment, in which alleles of different genes are sourced independently of one another during gamete formation.
Okay, wait, what is an allele?
Alleles are different types of the same gene. So, for example, because I know what my parents' eye colors were, I know I carry the brown eye and blue eye versions of the eye color genes. And these different versions of genes are called alleles. So they're just different types of the same gene that code to different things.
Oh, okay. All right.
And interestingly, Mendel was a contemporary of Darwin's, but Darwin didn't know about his work. And in fact, he had a logically unworkable idea of how genetics works, which is basically, I forget the relevant details, but it was something along the lines of, it takes the average of, you know, the father and the mother, and it combines the two like that. It was sort of weird stuff about how it reads in the body and then travels to the loins and strange things. And very unworkable. And in fact, it was one of the biggest objections to his work early on, was that he had no workable theory of how inheritance works. And it was Mendel, whose work went unrecognized for 40, 50 years, that really discovered how it works. I believe these laws are now known to be not quite accurate, you know, 100% of the time, like independent assortment. There are gene linkages, for example, where genes that are closer together on chromosomes are more likely to be inherited together, for example. But still, he was an amazing person who did quite fantastic experimental work way before other people did, although there are some suggestions that he might have fudged some of his results. There's some suggestion that his results were a bit too good to be actually true, that he might have faked some of it. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I've seen that allegation.
Alright, shall we move on to questions and corrections? And this week we have a correction from Pablo.
And I knew it. I knew it. I kept asking what the mirror was. Someone didn't want to listen about the mirror. And there was a mirror.
So tell us about the mirror.
Inside are the two telescopes. So because it's binocular, remember, there are two telescopes. Each has three curved rectangular mirrors. So there are six mirrors in total.
Thank you, Pablo.
And it's interesting that these are rectangular mirrors. Like Pablo also mentioned that he didn't know they existed in northern eye. Usually they tend to be, you know, circular or some, not rectangular usually.
Yeah, that does seem odd.
Well, I mean, and it's quite a big mirror as well. The largest mirror in each telescope is 1.45 meters by 0.5 meters.
Hmm.
It's not quite as big as Hubble. It's pretty damn big. And if you put 1.5 meters up above the atmosphere, you're going to have a beautiful view of what's happening.
It's quite a lot bigger than my little Dalsonian, let's put it that way.
Yeah, my Ukrainian doesn't come close. 4.5 inches, not even close.
No.
And when it comes to space equipment or astronomy, bigger is always bigger.
Indeed. That's true of most things in life, really.
Yep.
Once you go to ESA, you never go back.
All right, let's talk about the news.
Yay!
All right, and this week's first news story is about rinderpest, and it's extinct.
Oh, yeah.
And the story came to us courtesy of Chris Burkett. In past episodes, we've spoken a lot about smallpox and how it has been virtually rendered extinct in the wild through a combination of various different initiatives, most notably vaccination. But rinderpest is an animal disease which is related to measles, but it affects cloven-hoofed mammals, so that's things like cattle and giraffes and wildebeest and pigs and that sort of thing. So it really is a problem for livestock farmers in particular, because it's a very virulent disease. It's from the Morbillo virus genus, and it's a really, really nasty disease. It's not something that you want to have. And given that rinderpest was closely related to measles, some of the earliest attempts to create an inoculation for rinderpest were based off of measles, with limited success. In fact, there have been attempts for the last 200 or 300 years to try and eradicate rinderpest through things like attempted vaccinations and culling of whole herds of infected cattle and that sort of thing. It really has been a big problem for a long time. In the 1990s, the World Organization for Animal Health was formed to coordinate anti-rinderpest activities specifically to deal with rinderpest, which of course is the veterinary equivalent of the World Health Organization, which deals more with human diseases. And WOAH, or WHO,
good acronym,
coordinated a combination of widespread vaccinations and early detection surveillance tools that they managed to develop a cheap, easy, and portable test to see if cattle were infected with rinderpest, and they used a combination of these two approaches and pretty much wiped out rinderpest on all fronts.
Cool.
The last documented case of rinderpest was recorded in Kenya in 2001, and so WHO has been waiting for about 10 years or so just to make sure that no other cases have sprung up out of the blue, and they haven't. So in a ceremony a couple of weeks ago, WHO declared rinderpest extinct in the wild.
Good one, Derek. Well done.
So that's two for science.
Well,
100 billion for everybody else. Now, of course, like smallpox, rinderpest isn't completely gone. There are still samples of it in various laboratories around the world, and apparently some of those samples were even used in bioweapon developments that were looked into by the United States government at one point.
Someone should send the UN weapons inspection team in there and wipe it all out.
Indeed, yeah.
I think they're quite at the authority.
Well, just wait until Hans Blix here hears about this. He'll write a strongly worded letter.
Yeah, it might get vetoed at the Security Council, but who knows. Okay, so from wiping out one disease to hopefully wiping out another. So Africa now has a new nation, the nation of South Sudan, which became independent on July 9th. After a very long process, there was a referendum where upwards of 99% of the people in the referendum said, yes, we want to be independent from the north. And Sudan is sort of in the north of Africa, just south of Egypt. It is on the path of the Nile. And it's a fairly poverty-stricken country in, fact, whole area. But this independence is actually quite good news. Sudan, like most other African countries, was a creation of a bunch of Europeans in the 1900s drawing lines on maps, and the country wasn't really a proper entity ever, with the north dominated by Arabs and the south mostly by Christian animistic Bantu-speaking peoples. And these two groups never got along very well. There was a civil war for decades, but now they're independent. And as a result of this independence, there is new hope that human beings will be able to eradicate the guinea worm, which is a big problem in South Sudan. So the guinea worm is a parasitic nematode worm. You may remember nematodes from a couple of episodes ago. And they are pretty horrible creatures, these specific worms. The species is known as Gonconculus medinensis. And the first bit of the name is Latin for afflicted with little dragon. And what happens is these worms live in copepods, these small little arthropods, they're not quite insects, that live in water. And then people ingest or somehow come in contact with the copepods, which then get digested in their digestive system, but the worm eggs survive, and then they infect the person, which the males and the females are both in there, then they mate, and the females go into one of the body cavities, usually in the lower limbs, and then they sort of force their way out of your legs. And this happens about a year after being infected, and so you get this extremely painful blister that's apparently so sore in some cases you can't walk. And this worm head pops out of this blister, and the thing is a meter long. It's very thin, but it's about a meter long, and then inch by agonizing inch, you have to pull this thing out. Usually people take a little stick or something and roll it around the worm and try to pull it out, but this takes forever, and it's extremely painful. And of course, if something is painful and there's a burning sensation, what people do is they put their affected limb in water. But that's exactly the wrong thing to do, because once you do that, the female will then release a bunch of eggs back into the water supply, which then gets eaten by the copepods, which then starts the whole life cycle over again. So, as you might imagine, these things are just horrendous, and we've been trying to eradicate them for a while. And luckily, we have had quite a bit of success. In 2006, there were about 20,000 reported cases, mostly in Africa. But now we're down to either 4 or 5 countries, depending on how you count, and about 1,800 cases. And the very good news is in Ghana and Mali, which had cases in 2010, so far this year, no new cases have been reported.
Wow.
And in Ethiopia, only 3. And Chad, which was recently reinfested, only had 2, right? So only a tiny number of reported cases in these countries. But South Sudan is really the tough one. In 2010, there were about 1,700 cases.
Wow, so that's most of them.
Yeah, that's the vast majority of them. So far this year, up until April, there have been 371 cases. And the bad news there is that's about a 20% increase on the same period last year.
Not good.
But now that there is, at least hopefully, peace between North and South Sudan, and a more stable political system is hopefully going to be installed, and hopefully the country and its problems will receive more independent attention that cannot be blocked by the North, and humanitarian efforts will be able to go into this area, and the volunteers, that the campaign that has been spearheaded by the Carter Center, led by Jimmy Carter, the ex-US president and Nobel Peace Prize winner, and this campaign is out there attempting to stop the spread of this disease. And the primary way they do it is that when someone is infected, they sort of monitor them and they prevent them from putting their infected areas into water. So they, you know, get treatment, they get help, and they get educated about how not to spread this disease. And education is obviously the big key here, because once you know, well, it actually helps the worm to put it in water, people realize, well, let's not do that, or let's do it with a bucket or something instead of going to a stream. And the people in charge of this campaign are quite optimistic about the future. Apparently this 18% increase can possibly be attributed to the election last year, which was the vote about whether South Sudan should become independent or not, because there was all the fears about violence of the campaign, or the support staff for the campaign were withdrawn for a while. So that year there was a bit of a problem, but they think now by 2013 or 2014 they can eradicate this disease in South Sudan, which is the largest remaining pocket of it. And once that's gone, and if the efforts in Ghana, Mali, and in Ethiopia and Chad continue to be successful, we're going to be rid of another human pestilence that has been described for thousands of years. It's been described by the ancient Greeks already, the guinea worm. So let's hope that happens.
That's very exciting.
Well, one thing with this, I suppose you can't really keep it in a lab. Maybe you could freeze the eggs or something, but I don't think you're going to have very many volunteers to... Yeah, I'll incubate some guinea worm for you in my leg.
I assume you don't just get one female who is wrapped from your body. I assume there are more than one.
You can apparently get up to 60.
Holy crap.
So you can imagine, and it's not only your legs and arms, it really can be anywhere, it's mostly your limbs, but it can be anywhere, so it's most unfit.
Wow.
It's a good thing that excruciating pain is apparent for the movie crowd, otherwise you'd have guinea worms as a there's some kind of cure for something indistinct and same, like chronic fatigue syndrome.
Well, I'm sure once you are infected with guinea worms, chronic fatigue won't be your biggest problem.
Yeah, let's all not try.
Alright, let's talk about jelly made from people.
Jelly made from people, oh my god! So, Boing Boing went a little bit crazy with a article entitled, "On the Lines of Jelly Made from People," which is slightly overstated, but let me give you some of the details.
Jelly as in the jelly you eat for dessert? Or
yes.
Something? Okay. I'm not going to eat jelly made from people.
I don't want,
you can't make me. You can't make me! I'm genetically engineered, but not
people.
Not people. This is not starvation sci-fi movies.
There are a lot of people.
There are a lot of people.
It's an abundant food source.
Yeah.
Well, look, if it's ever the, you know, there's a nuclear apocalypse or something, and I'm hungry, your ass is on the braai. But when I have a choice, I'm not going to be eating jelly made out of people.
Yeah. Well, luckily you probably won't have to have that first. Gelatin-based products like jelly, marshmallows, candy, pharmaceuticals, and cosmetics.
Pharmaceuticals? They put jelly in pharmaceuticals.
Oh. Gelatin.
Yeah.
They are widespread, and we use a lot of gelatin. Jelly itself is denatured collagen, which is normally made from bone and skin products of dead animals, especially cows and pigs. So next time you have a jelly baby, stick to the cows.
Or the pigs.
Or the pigs.
Look at that project.
The problem with this, obviously, is the risk of diseases, such as prion diseases,
right,
which you might know better as mad cow disease. Also, some people can have an immune reaction to this particular capacity of gelatin. Oh, woe for the industrialist, you could get an inconsistent product.
Oh, no.
Wouldn't want a little bit of inconsistent marshmallow to eat it.
I like my marshmallows consistent.
Yes, this one's black. So a group of researchers led by, now please forgive me, but I don't know how to pronounce this, Huiming Duan et al. Have published an article in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Policy in which they explain a process by which they use rat and mouse genes together with a yeast for Pteosaurus, which then produced a gelatin-like product that responded and behaved exactly the same way as the bone and skin derived gelatin. Yeah, so there's quite a reasonable possibility that we will be able to actually use human genes as a replacement for the rat and mouse genes, and thereby have non-animal derived gelatin to replace the 300,000 tons of animal-based gelatin that we consume each year.
Okay, so it'll be essentially become a biotechnology product we grow in the vats of yeast using human genes. Now, people are going to be squeamish about this.
Yeah, I predict the organic food lobby are going to lose their goddamn minds over that.
Right.
But, I mean, they already have, and on a misunderstanding, this is not jelly made for people. You're not taking your brain and popping it on a plate, right? You're actually... you know, you're using a little bit of science and, you know, providing...
Oh, a lot of science.
Yeah.
To be fair, they're genetically engineering yeast with mouse juice. That's a lot of science.
Yay. So, Frankenjelly.
What's this process be an order of magnitude more expensive than just taking the... Presumably they take leftover parts from the pigs and so on, which gets slaughtered for their meat, and then those extra bits get used to make gelatin.
Well, look, it's economies of scale, right? So at first it would be probably prohibitively expensive to do that kind of thing. But as the market demand starts to pick up, then you'll see a shift away from deriving the stuff from dead pigs, and you'll see the synthesis of it becoming more profitable, and will probably take over. It's hard to predict these things, but like we spoke about last week with aspirin being derived from willow bark, they don't do that anymore because willow trees are hard to grow. Well, you know, pigs might also be hard to grow relative to yeast, so that we might see a shift at some point in the future.
I think something that you've just missed there is what are we going to do with pig bones and cow skin, which is basically what we're taking here. We're effectively using the byproduct of us wanting to eat juicy steak. I'm not going to want to stop eating juicy steak because I can eat human jelly instead. No way, Jose.
Well, I think we should use the pig bones and cow skin to stop the warming somehow.
Make a big tank.
Something like that, yeah.
Just blast it into space, it reflects sunlight, right? So it could reduce the albedo. Right?
Perfect.
Could do that.
Sorted.
Wow.
Okay. but, who knows, maybe once we get lab-grown meat, which is on the horizon.
Right.
It's not in the next couple of years, but probably in the next decade or two, this is going to become commercially possible. And I, for one, see no, absolutely no moral, ethical, religious, any problem with doing that thing. It's just meat without a central nervous system, and then central nervous system is the thing that does the thinking, the feeling, and if nothing has to suffer for me to have bacon, I'm a lot happier, because pigs are disgustingly intelligent.
Indeed, and bacon is delicious.
And bacon is delicious. So,
what do you do?
What do you do? Well, the answer is, let's eat lab-grown meat. And I suppose once there's lab-grown meat, you're going to need so many jelly products, and so this is a way to solve that problem.
Awesome.
This is not close to being commercially viable, obviously, because they've even done the proof of principle with human beings. They've just sort of said, well, we've done it with rats. It's assuming that rats and mice and humans have highly conserved genes to create some gelatin-like proteins or this collagen.
Well, yeah, they make collagen, and we all make collagen.
Sure, I mean, it's an open question about whether they're highly conserved or not. I don't know. It seems speculative. It's still a really cool story, and I love that Boing Boing totally messed it up.
Cool. We're not talking about Soylent Green.
Yeah.
I'd love to see Soylent Green flavored human jelly, though. I would so buy that.
Yeah, but would you eat it?
I would put it in a brain-shaped mold, and I would eat it.
Good idea.
All right, let's talk about Dawn reaching Vesta. What is a what? What is Dawn and what is Vesta and what?
Okay, so Dawn, you know when the sun comes up?
Oh, no.
Dawn is a spacecraft. It's a NASA spacecraft with some contribution from the European Space Agency as well, with some of the instruments built by the Europeans. And it was launched on September 27, 2007 as part of that very successful discovery program that we've discussed before, of sort of medium-priced science missions. And Dawn is a unique and very awesome spacecraft, and it has just reached on July 16th, which is yesterday as we're recording this, it reached Vesta, which is the second largest asteroid in the asteroid belt. As you may know, the asteroid belt is a region of asteroids between Mars and Jupiter. Don't imagine this as like in Star Wars, you know, when they're going to the asteroid field and the android says there's a 1 to 6 million point 5 chance of us passing through an asteroid flying all over the show and they're shooting them and it's not like that, right? They're very, very far apart. And Vesta is in there between Mars and Jupiter, as I said, and it's hypothesized that this region is sort of a failed planet because of Jupiter and Saturn's combined gravity that prevented from being formed in the early solar system, although that is up for dispute. And the material these asteroids are made of are some of the oldest surviving unchanged material in the solar system. Very old. And Vesta is a very large asteroid. It's second largest of the series. And Vesta is about 520 kilometers in diameter.
That's pretty big.
It's very big. And it has all sorts of interesting features. Some people argue it might actually be a protoplanet on the definition of the International Astronomical Union's sort of list of criteria you need to be a protoplanet. But Dawn reaching it and studying it for the next year is possibly going to nail that down. Despite being so small, Vesta has a metallic core, and in addition, it has a massive crater, like 400 kilometers long.
Wow.
On its south pole, right? So most of its surface in the sort of south side of the asteroid is covered by the giant impact, which occurred roughly about 1 billion years ago and excavated up to 1% of its mass.
Wow.
And scattered that through the solar system. And a lot of the meteors we have on Earth, around, I think it's around 5%, come from Vesta. And Dawn is now around it. And the other thing that makes Dawn rather interesting and unique is that it will be the first human spacecraft to travel on its own power to one body, go into orbit, then leave that orbit and go to another body and orbit it instead. A year from now, in July 2012, it will leave Vesta's orbit and head for Ceres, and it will then orbit that for as long as they can keep the mission running and study that as well. So we're getting an up close and personal look at two very large and very interesting asteroids in the asteroid belt with this one single mission. Pretty awesome.
So Ceres is the largest of the asteroids.
Yes.
Is it one of the new class of planets that the...
It is a protoplanet. Yes.
Protoplanet. Okay.
What do you have to be to be a protoplanet? You mentioned requirements.
I think there are a whole list. I can't remember them now, but I think the one that is up for dispute when it comes to test, and I could be wrong here, is the hydrostatic equilibrium in being nearly spherical. So because of this massive gouge that this asteroid collided with it a billion years ago, caused its shape to be somewhat non-spherical. So that is one of the main reasons, as far as I understand it, why it's not currently being listed as a protoplanet, but it might in fact be one.
Well, it looks pretty spherical. If you look at the images we do have of it, obviously we haven't had anything close up, but the images we've got make it look pretty spherical to me.
It is pretty spherical, but, you know, there's still debate about whether it actually formally meets the definition or not. And the reason Dawn can travel to Vesta on its own power and then leave orbit again is because it uses an ion engine.
Awesome.
Sweet.
Which is an extraordinarily efficient type of engine for, you know, the couple of hundred kilograms of xenon gas that it uses, that it propels out the rear, out of the thrusters. It can, you know, use most of the energy that actually generated in that process. Unlike, for example, a rocket, which uses only a tiny percent of the energy actually released. So it's an extremely efficient engine.
We are living in the future.
That's right, people.
We are. I mean, unfortunately, it's very efficient, but the total power it provides is tiny.
Yeah, it's not very good at acceleration. But
no, it really isn't.
But it's really good at top end.
It's just a slow, steady acceleration that can go on for a long time. One comparison I read said the output of one of these engines is about 1/50th of a small cracker, small, little bit of firewood, right? So it's a tiny acceleration, but because it's so efficient and because you can take your time when you're in space, it doesn't matter. It ends up being a very economical way of traveling around.
I stand to be corrected here, but currently the fastest moving man-made object is the experimental probe Deep Space One, which was the prototype for the ion engine.
Yes.
So it took a long time. It took several years to get up to speed, but now that it's had a few years to accelerate, it is moving out of the solar system faster than anything else we've got. Give it a few more years and it'll be overtaking the Pioneer and Voyager probes.
Cool.
Very awesome.
So from awesome to not awesome.
Goddamn stupid.
Again.
Every week.
Sammy, something stupid happens once a week. I'm shocked.
Something stupid happens every week on this podcast.
Well, what do you mean?
Don't worry, baby.
Well, this is actually what we're going to discuss now happened about a month ago.
Yes, and it's taken this long to come to our attention because we don't watch Mnet.
Or anything.
this story comes to us by a blog post by our friend Tarek Musa, who wrote about a story that appeared on the pseudo-journalism show Carte Blanche on Mnet.
I wouldn't go. Carte Blanche has some good journalism on it. When it deals with political subjects, the problem is the journalists, you know, are skeptical in a proper, cynical, and hard-hitting, hard-nosed way when it comes to political questions of corruption and so on. But when they turn to science, that the fail happens.
Yes, yeah.
I'm yet to see anything truly egregious of a political nature on part. Granted, I don't watch that.
Yeah.
But it's a weekly sort of magazine investigative journalism show,
right,
on the cable television network in South Africa called Mnet. This episode that we'll link to, you can watch the whole insert, not the whole episode, but you can watch an insert about ghosts.
Oh,
ghosts. Awesome.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, you know.
It seems to be. The presenter seems the whole way through to sort of be politely amused.
Yeah, he's sort of smirking a little bit.
But that didn't stop him from filling it with fail.
Yep, it did not indeed.
Right, yeah. So the premise of the story is that there are several prominent ghosts around South Africa, and the one in particular that they focused on in the story was Daisy de Melka, who was a convicted murderer in the early 20th century in Johannesburg. She was convicted for murdering one of her husbands.
No, she was found guilty of murdering her son.
Oh, right, that's right.
And suspected to have murdered two of her sisters.
Right.
Wow, yeah. Nice lady.
Yeah, indeed. So she's from a nice lady, and she was sentenced to death early in the 20th century.
I think she was killed in the 13th century.
Sounds about right. Her name has lived on in infamy in Southern African mythology since then. And now there's a whole raft of stories about her ghost in various places around the place, rising up. And that's what this insert was really about. And they consulted a bunch of experts. Now, the first group of experts they spoke to were people who are expert in EVP, or electronic voice phenomena.
Well, to call us experts in EVP is a little bit rich.
I'm an expert in unicorn farts.
That explains a lot. What Carte Blanche did is they went to what is now sort of a museum prison, if that makes any sense, which is at Constitutional Hill in Johannesburg, where the Constitutional Court is. And this is the prison in which Daisy de Melker was held once she was found guilty of being dead. And the first two people who come in are paranormal investigators, Nikki Carter and Lance Hutchinson. And Nikki is an expert because she heard the voice of her dead father in an electronic voice recording.
Right, that of course clearly makes her an expert.
Yes. Absolutely. She's been doing this for many years.
Right.
And, listening very closely to static and finding voices. And that pretty much sums up the electronic voice phenomenon as a whole. If we can just go into a little bit of what EVP probably is, why we misinterpret as ghosts. Perception is a complex process, so what your brain perceives may not necessarily be what's actually happening. Specifically where things are complicated by some kind of deeply held emotional desire, like wanting to speak to dead people, to hear the voices of family members who have passed on, desperately want to know that there is an afterlife or something after death, and that people who have died can still communicate with us in some way. And so Nikki and her scientist Lance set up a laptop with some kind of sensor recording device, which they didn't show us very clearly, and then they recorded something that in the prison. But they didn't show us any result of this specific recording at all. They didn't show a single thing about what was recorded at the prison. What they showed us was some historical recordings that Nikki had made of what she was convinced was her dead father, telling her to drive safely, that he loves her, and she must sleep well at night. And that was it.
And it's interesting that there's, even though they're shown to be setting up in various places with ghostly reputations, they don't actually play any recorded sounds that these people pick up. So it's clear that they don't actually have the voice recording of Daisy de Melker, right? If they had that, I would have been slightly more impressed. And if that message included something along the lines of, by the way, I also killed one of my children who is buried here, and we went to go dig there and found a dead body that was poisoned, then I would have been impressed.
Indeed.
Instead, we have these two people who sort of set up there and then don't have any results, and this woman, Nikki Carter, then says, well, I'm an expert because I hear my daddy's voice in random sounds.
And we're primed, right? Before they play us the sound of what she claims is her throat. She claims it's not her father's voice, but she sort of tacitly endorses that it is her father, based on what she claims to have heard. She specifically says, I'm not saying this is my father's voice, but I heard him say he loves me, and I'm not saying I'm going to sleep well.
It could just be some creepy ghost.
It could just be some
dead stalker.
If I can give you a breather.
Oh, God. So, before we hear these things, we're told what he said, and then it's taken to two sound engineers, and I have nothing against sound engineers. It is a damn hard job, as I'm finding out in this podcast. It's not an easy job. And they are then asked to find anything peculiar at a very low level, and which they then do. And surprise, surprise, they hear what we were told we would hear. So we were primed beforehand. And given that we can routinely demonstrate this effect, that if you sort of tell people what you're expected to hear and then play random noise, they can find that sound. It's something your brain does. Your brain is incredibly sophisticated. And it is very good at filling in the blank, at drawing a full picture. And if it's a visual cue, we call it visual pareidolia. If you've seen anything in the news about the face of Jesus on a piece of toast, or the Virgin Mary on a glass fronted building, or anything like that, or Jesus in a doggy's bum, which I've seen, it's pretty cool.
Jesus is everywhere, including on a dog's bum.
That is visual pareidolia. That's your brain finding a pattern in random visual noise.
And the face on Mars, and if you go lie on your back during the day and look up at clouds, you're almost guaranteed to see shape in the clouds. And that's pareidolia. It's a very well-known and thoroughly studied phenomenon that causes a lot of confusion. Like all sorts of religious iconography is just simply pareidolia. You know, people look at oil stains or bark or toast and they find something or another, whatever the previous belief system. If you happen to be Catholic, you see pieces of toast with the Virgin Mary on it. If you're Muslim, you know, it's the Prophet Muhammad or, you know, whatever.
You'll never find a Mormon seeing Vishnu in his toast.
There was a satirical piece a while back about an atheist finding an image of the Big Bang on toast.
Lovely.
We'll link to that. That's pretty funny.
Okay, so that's visual pareidolia. Auditory pareidolia is very similar. When your brain patches in the blank and finds voices or familiar sounds or something in white noise. And I have a great quote from a psychologist called Jim Alcock, who says that it is only parsimonious to suggest that what people hear with EDC is also the product of their own brain and their expectations rather than the voices of the dearly departed. And he has established this through many years of experiments and with testing people and finding auditory pareidolia coming through. That's sort of the scientific explanation for it, but Nikki Carter has a separate explanation for it. She says it's a low-frequency digital sound.
Oh, that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense.
Because, of course, you know, the spirits of the dead would use low-frequency digital sound particularly, specifically, to the exclusion of anything else.
Well, she has a fantastic reason why.
Oh.
But it's because we're in a much denser energetic bandwidth, so to speak.
What?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
What is this? I don't even...
Like, yeah,
this is a point Tariq makes as well.
And it's a point that lots of people have made many, many, many times about the whole energy thing that is useful.
Yeah, so people tend to misuse words like energy and bandwidth and, you know, frequency and vibration because they don't actually understand what they mean. So they'll throw those words around because they sound impressive but really don't have a clue.
Well, energy has a very specific physical meaning.
Right.
There are a couple of very good posts, including one by Dr. Burt, who no longer blogs, but there's a fantastic blog post explaining exactly the history of the concept of physical energy and how it arose and what exactly it means. And unless you're a physicist or using a physically derived specific meaning of energy, you're just making stuff up when you're saying things like dense or energetic bandwidth. That's just bad techno babble.
That's gobbledygook. They wouldn't even put that into an episode of Star Trek.
And they do some stupid things.
That makes no sense.
No, I just don't know. I'm sorry, I can't make it fit. Can't make it fit. So, yeah, that's just ridiculous. Anyway.
Well, the second part of the piece on carte blanche, they did some infrared things.
Pretty awesome.
It was pretty awesome. They managed to get a team of engineers from Denel, which is a major company that produces high-tech weaponry here in South Africa. And these particular engineers were the guys who build heat-seeking missiles and bombs. And they brought some of their infrared equipment to come and stare at the empty cell where Daisy DeMelka was supposedly housed many decades ago. And that's what they did. So they came and they brought their awesome, awesome infrared equipment. And if you watch the video clip, you'll see how sensitive this infrared equipment is. Just by rubbing his finger on the wall, one of the guys was able to write a message that was visible in the infrared. So it was really, really impressive. Indeed. And so they set their equipment up and pointed it at the cell, waited for an hour, and then pretty much gave up because they didn't detect anything, which was no surprise to anybody. But now there are several problems with this part of the insert. First of all, these engineers were repeatedly described as scientists. Now, engineers and scientists aren't really the same thing.
Right.
You know, there's a pretty clear distinction there, and it's you know, I don't think it's worth going into a lot of detail here, but suffice to say, engineers and scientists are not necessarily the same thing. Secondly, the whole stunt was based on an underlying presumption that ghosts can be detected by using infrared scanning equipment. Now, infrared radiation is present when there is heat, and the stated major premise here is that where ghosts are, you have a sudden decrease of temperature. But that has yet to be demonstrated empirically. There's no reason to believe that that's true other than some anecdotal reports. So what we're doing here is we're using a methodology based on an unsupported conclusion to try and prove something else. It's not sound scientific or any other kind of reasoning.
And it's not a proper experiment.
Right, exactly. Oh. I mean, they only sat there for an hour, right? So if they were seriously looking for ghosts, which obviously they weren't, it was just a tongue-in-cheek piece, but if they really were looking for ghosts, they would have had to sit there all night, every night, for several days at least, and just to make sure that they had a proper amount of data to base their conclusions on.
But even if they, let's say they got a hit, there was a sudden unexplained drop in temperature in one little spot. Right. What would that prove?
Yeah, what would that signify? Yeah.
All it would prove is that there was a sudden drop in temperature in that spot. But
which could be due to many things.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And also, there was no control, as you would have in a proper scientific experiment. But they would have to set up their equipment in a similar location and stare at that for days on end and see what happened. As far as we saw, there was no such thing.
Yeah. And we weren't setting out with the goal of proving a hypothesis. We had a hypothesis.
Right.
We already know we're looking for ghosts. We've been told that this room is haunted. And that, you know, we're like, well, that's what we're looking for. Oops, we didn't find it. We're not deterred. Believe me, we are not deterred. We're going to keep looking.
Well, not the Dunnell guys.
Yeah, no.
They seem very skeptical. Apparently there was some discussion at the company beforehand, should we participate in this? But they went ahead, which is fine, I think, for a sort of a fluff piece,
yeah,
to get some free promotion for their company.
It's fun to show off their awesome gadgets.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, if you were to be generous, I would say this was what is known as a Baconian experiment instead of a Galilean experiment, where a Baconian experiment is you sort of just observe and change a few things and see what happens. And this distinction is due to Peter Medawar, the great science writer and Nobel laureate in medicine. Whereas a Galilean experiment is what we now think of as a proper scientific experiment that tests a hypothesis and is in some sense crucial, that finding X tells you Y and finding not X tells you not Y. That is what a proper experiment is supposed to do. Either result gives you information, whereas in this case, both results tell you nothing. Right? If they found something, a drop in temperature, that doesn't tell you it's a ghost. And if they didn't find anything, well, they've only observed for an hour, so that doesn't tell you anything either, because maybe the ghost was just shy of the equipment, or the ghost was, apparently this ghost moves around. Right? It's a really busy ghost. It's a constitutional hill, and it's a various other places, the same one ghost. Right? So maybe it was just at some other location. Right? So for both outcomes of the, you know, this observation, you have no clear proper outcome. So it was deeply flawed in many respects, as Owen has pointed out.
I mean, and even if it wasn't flawed, even if it was a properly designed experiment, the believers wouldn't have bought the negative results anyway, because this is where they come with their arguments from special pleading and say things like, you can't detect spirits with the tools of science and your Western empirical paradigm and things like that.
Well,
this is the kind of crap that they say.
As crazy as it sounds, I don't think it's entirely incorrect.
No, it's not.
You can't detect spirits with the Western empirical tools of science because these tools are not designed for detecting spirits.
Right, because the spirits haven't been defined. How
no.
do you know?
But they could be, right? If there were ghosts, let's say there were the residue of someone's intellect or consciousness what somehow did survive after death and somehow did cause a drop in temperature, we would know it, right? But the point is, because you don't have a proper definition beforehand of what a ghost is and what characteristics it has, it's very easy to say, well, why do you think ghosts drop temperature? Like, it's, the existence of ghosts is compatible with the hypothesis that they don't drop temperature. Like, maybe they increase it. Maybe they don't have any effect there at all. Maybe they just have an effect in the radio frequency or whatever, right? Maybe they do exist, but it changes some physical constant or some, you know, some force we're not even aware of, right? Doing it in this way is just deeply limiting and flawed. But I agree with Anne that because we haven't detected anything so far, it's naive to assume that you can just take this equipment, look at it for an hour at one spot that supposedly has the highest paranormal activity in the world. Oh, that's a term that no one knows. Well, it's right. I mean, it does have the highest paranormal activity in the world, just like every other spot in the world.
I mean, what we're doing is we're taking these tools that are designed for other, with other goals in mind, and
sure.
we are trawling through massive amounts of data, photographs and digital recordings and infrared recordings, and looking for any anomaly. We are hunting for anomalies. And when we find an anomaly, we go, oh, it's the ghost of my grandfather telling me not to drive around that corner tomorrow because, oh wait, just telling me to drive carefully. Yeah.
But in this case, they didn't even find anomalies.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's the worst of it. They created this entire story
over nothing.
And didn't even have a single anomaly that easily explained away. Right? All they had was an anecdote from this paranormal researcher. So the psychic goes by the name Jeanette McKenzie, and she walks around the, I wouldn't say set, or she walks around and basically confabulates and makes things up as she goes along, and claims she's sensing what's going on, and this is supposed to be impressive. So she would do things like walk into a particular cell at the Constitutional Hill and say, yeah, I can see someone sitting naked in the corner, or someone is reaching out to touch me, or, you know, I feel like my fingernails are being pulled out, or, you know, just confabulating, really. She's walking around claiming she's sensing things. And here's a quote from the show. So she's speaking about Daisy DeMelco and trying to explain what she felt. So she was contacted by the Carte Blanche producers, and this is what her explanation is of what happens next. First of all, I pick up the energy, and then secondly, she's like standing there, and there's mist in front of her. Like,
wow.
That's impressive, because that's how ghosts always manifest. Mm-hmm. You feel energy, whatever that means, and then there's sort of like mist and everything.
Right.
Very spooky.
Very spooky indeed. and she claims never to have heard of Daisy DeMelco before being contacted by Carte Blanche.
Which is pretty unlikely. Well, as Michael said, her accent suggests that she wasn't born and raised in South Africa, but she's obviously been here for some time, and to never have heard of Daisy DeMelco is pretty unlikely.
I've never heard of her before today, actually.
Okay, I learned about Daisy DeMelco in school. Maybe they changed the syllabus by the time you guys got there.
As soon as McKenzie had finished speaking to Carte Blanche, someone who'd never contacted her amazing psychicness before suddenly came to contact her and caused all kinds of deep personal revelations.
I also have a spirit that comes and tells me all about these sorts of things that's called Google.
Yeah, there's this network of computers linked together. I use that. It does use energy and stuff.
Yes, it does.
And the internet is kind of metaphysical.
Yes, and it's also kind of misty, you know, the cloud.
But there's the cloud. Ah, yeah, that makes sense. No wonder she saw mist in front of her and felt energy. That's what I do when I go to google.com. and she has these revelations, and I'm speaking about the psychic, the late psychic, who says that Daisy DeMelco contacted her soon afterwards, after speaking to the producers for the first time, and for some reason unknown to anyone, DeMelco decided to reveal secrets to Jeanette McKenzie, including that she was abused as a child, and that's why she ended up being a alleged serial killer. And DeMelco also allegedly revealed that she committed other murders that aren't known about, specifically at the Transvaal Children's Hospital, where she worked as a nurse, and apparently she killed some children, and this is what McKenzie said.
There's no evidence, or even hearsay, for any.
Right, there's no reason to suspect that any of this is true. Also, McKenzie claims that she had no idea that DeMelco worked with children, but again, of course, this is something we were able to confirm with Google.
Within about 3 minutes of looking her up on Wikipedia.
Right, it's very easy to say that you didn't know about things after the fact.
Yeah. I mean, even if she didn't really know, but she knew Daisy DeMelco was a working woman, and this is a point her Musa makes, that a woman around the 1900s who had a job is fairly likely to be a nurse, right? It's not, certainly not 100%, maybe not even 20%, but, you know, it's a high probability here to assume a working woman during that time was a nurse.
Well, however she found her information, and we say that it was probably on the internet, because let's face it, that is the best source of information right now for someone who's just looking up a couple of quick facts. And it clearly states when it discusses on Wikipedia, when they discuss DeMarco's so-called criminal history, that she was studying to become a nurse, is clearly stated. And, you know, I mean, so you don't have to be a professional. You don't have to know all about Daisy DeMarco and curate the DeMarco Museum of Toxins, or whatever. You just need to be able to look her up on Wikipedia or any other source, which all seems to be popping wildly between each other. And
there's also this thing called source amnesia, where people who hear something often can't remember where they got that information from. You know, I've suffered from this on many occasions, and I've seen other people suffer from it as well. And she, a charitable reading of Mackenzie claims that she read these things about DeMarco in her media profile or in a book or whatever, and then forgot this is where she got the information, and then later convinced herself that she found out about it inside the news. That is stretching it a little bit, but probably the most parsimonious explanation is that she's a psychic, therefore she's a liar, which is usually an accurate assumption to make, or at a minimum fairly delusional, not in a completely insane kind of way delusional, but in the sense of having a fantasy-prone personality, which is what often these sort of psychics have, is just a propensity toward confabulation, of not being able to distinguish reality from fantasy. And I've met people like this. In fact, someone like this has sat in this very living room. I won't name any names, but you know, where it's clear that this person really doesn't quite distinguish between reality and fantasy. It's quite scary to watch. You know, it's very disconcerting that this person clearly is living somewhat in their head. And, of course, just plain old mental illness is very common. The human brain is a complex system that functions well or perfectly only some of the time, and people suffer from all sorts of problems, including schizophrenia and hearing voices, and at least some of these people become convinced this must be a message from the other side and to become psychic. I don't know this Jeanette Mackenzie woman from a bar of soap, so I don't know what is true, but what you don't have to assume is that the only way she could have gotten her information was from some sort of paranormal means. She provided no new and verifiable information. As we said earlier, if this woman had given us definitely unknown information, unknown to history, and we can then go confirm that information by digging somewhere or whatever, then that would be impressive. But her having the information she claims to have is perfectly consistent with her being a liar or delusional.
Or a good reader of the
book. Well, the child abuse and murder stuff, she either found that out psychically and we've not confirmed it, or she's lying about it, or she's somehow delusional, right? Because that's nowhere. You know, no one has made those claims for it itself.
Yeah. No, it's a fairly high probability guess, I'd say. I mean, if somebody is so broken that they're able to murder their own child, I'd say it's a fairly good hit to suggest that they may have a violent past. Having been subject to child abuse may well explain that sort of thing, but again, it's unverifiable. There's no way for us to check that.
And that plays into a very lazy narrative of trying to explain serial killers. It's a very popular sort of thing you see in movies or you see in journalism often, where, oh, this person is a serial killer and they were abused as a child, therefore the one explains the other. And I'd be very surprised if even a large percentage of abused people became somehow violent, or wouldn't have become violent anyway, in spite of, not because of the violence.
So, you know, Carte Blanche just completely missed on this one. Unless all you were trying to do was put in a fluff piece so that we could have something spooky and we could do some clever camera work, which the camera work is very pretty, especially that moon through the barbed wire thing. But really, guys, come on now.
There's a little thing you might want to look into called journalism. Look it up on Wikipedia. We'll send you a link.
And integrity.
And I mean, they do a lot of good work on integrity.
And this is not the first time they've fallen into this pseudoscience paranormal nonsense. They were also complicit in the rise of
Donnie Krupel,
the finder who could use his magical black box that no one was allowed to inspect. You know, you insert a bit of DNA into it, and voila, it has the GPS or the coordinates of anyone who's
it's
missing.
So, of course, it's quantum.
Yeah, it's quantum. Allegedly.
Yeah.
We've covered this in previous episodes, but he really reached critical mass after appearing on Carte Blanche. So there is a little bit of a history of bad journalism, of being credulous on the show. Okay, so fail from Carte Blanche. Guys, seriously, it must be a better job. And the worst thing was that they didn't even have token skepticism.
Yeah.
They had people who were supposedly skeptical, and they specifically mentioned Janu Muller and Tim Pringle, who were two sound engineers, who Angela mentioned before as well, and they were apparently quite skeptical beforehand, but after listening to the audio, they were convinced that it said what the paranormal investigator Nikki Carter said it said. But of course, these people aren't necessarily au fait with pareidolia, right? So they might know a lot about sound engineering. They probably know an order of magnitude more about sound engineering than all three of them combined. But that doesn't mean they know anything about the causes of people believing in weird things like pareidolia.
We don't even know what their opinion is because they're never actually interviewed. We never hear their words.
They're described as the naysayers, and that's it.
And they're never actually given any camera time where they speak.
Right.
They're just shown analyzing it, and they say, oh yeah, that definitely sounds like it's saying X.
Yeah.
It's never where they're saying, well, it could be this or it could be that. They're never even given proper time. And they don't have any scientists on it. They have engineers.
And the engineers are admittedly, they do say there's no evidence of it.
Yeah.
Sure. So I think the engineers do a fairly good job within the time and space they were allowed. But not to have a skeptic come on and say, okay, this could be the case, but look, here's about pareidolia, or here's something about electronic voice phenomena. Not even having that little bit of token skepticism in there is really, really quite shocking. It's bad enough to have a fluff piece, but to have a fluff piece with no even token skepticism is really rather inexcusable, in my opinion.
You know, we're here, guys. We're the howplayingskeptics.org. We are here. If you need to ask a question, ask us. We will answer you the best way we can.
ConcilianceCast@gmail.com.
Yes.
We will do the best to be our token skeptics.
We are available. We're reasonably good looking. You can put us on camera.
Well, Angela is.
No, that's not speaking for the rest of us.
Yeah. Angela's hot. You can get her on camera and, you know, she can be the token skeptic. And it'll just work out nice. But not to have any skepticism, or to have a freaking scientist on, right? Engineers are not scientists.
Well, to be fair, there's no such thing as a ghostologist, right? There are no scientists operating in this field.
No, but
it's not a scientific field.
There are psychologists.
Right.
Right. And a psychologist can explain to you why you pick up EVP as being a voice instead of just some background noise.
But
and that needs to happen.
Also, why we have skeptics is to address exactly these kinds of fringe claims that there is no professor of skepticism.
Yeah.
As far as I know, anywhere in the world.
No, because real scientists couldn't be bothered.
Yes.
You don't see astronomers and astrologers debating whether or not Jupiter is influencing my life. They just don't do it. The astronomers go, you know what? No, I'm doing science. The rest of you guys can bug off. And leave it to us here to bug it and me too.
Right, that's our role. That's our function.
Hi, I'm Carl Zimmer from The Loom, and you're listening to Consilience.
Then let's move on to our quote of the week, our science fiction and fantasy quote. This one comes from The Hogfather by Terry Pratchett, and it is, "The truth may be out there, but the lies are inside your head."
Brilliant. That's so appropriate.
That's a good one. That's a middle finger to the X-Files.
All right, we have a couple of announcements this week. My first announcement relates to listeners in Durban, and that is Skeptics in the Pub. That is this coming Thursday on the 21st of July at 6 o'clock. The venue hasn't been decided yet, but hopefully when Clint manages to make his way back from TAM, he'll be updating the Facebook page with the relevant venue.
Probably going to be Bezetta again.
Probably.
Yeah.
And there's a topic this month. The topic is angry skepticism. Do you know an angry skeptic? Do you think they hurt the cause of skepticism? Sounds like a rousing... Sounds like there'll be a rousing discussion at this month's Skeptics in the Pub in Durban. Our second announcement is in Joburg, and that is the Speak to a Scientist, which is a monthly event at the Cybono Discovery Center. And this month, the speaker will be Cedric Abrahams, who comes from the Science Fiction and Fantasy South Africa, and his topic is Science in Science Fiction. And that'll be on the following Thursday, that's the 28th of July at 6:30, that's at the Cybono Discovery Center in Miriam Makeba Street in Newtown in Joburg. We'll be there, and we hope to see you guys there too.
Owen, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Google Plus, and you can go there by going to owenswat.org, and that'll take you to Google Plus.
That's terribly convenient.
I know. Angela, where can people find you on the internet?
My blog is skepticdetective.wordpress.com, and I tweet at Angela Mead.
Nice. And Mike, where can we find you on the internet?
I blog at Ionian Enchantment. I tweet or Twitter reply something at Michael Meaden. And I'm also on Google Plus, so feel free to add me.
Yeah, I am too.
Nice. All the cool people are on Google Plus.
I was one of the first cool people on Google Plus.
So was I. So was I, because Facebook is dead, let's face it.
Yeah, I'm not going back.
Yeah, Facebook schmacebook. Okay, that's all we have for you this week. Thanks to my co-hosts and to you, the listeners. Be sure to join us again next week for more Consilience.
Listening to Consilience. Our website is conciliencecast.wordpress.com, and you can send us an email to conciliencecast@gmail.com. Theme music is The Optimist by Zoe Keating from freemusicarchive.org.